We're now studying about the descendants of Josiah, those ones that reigned on the throne of Judah after him. We have started into that. As we did, we looked at the genealogy that we have in 1 Chronicles chapter 3 that gives the descendants of King David, and particularly gives us the descendants of the royal line through him, those ones that reigned as kings over Judah on David's throne. We do have a listing of all of the sons of that were born to David, both in Hebron and then later in Jerusalem during his reign, which of course included Solomon, who reigned after him, and then the descendants of Solomon, starting with Rehoboam, and that's traced all the way down to Josiah, which is where we are in our study now as we see his descendants. And 1 Chronicles 3, verse 15, gives the names of his four sons in their birth order. And Johanan, Jehoiakim, Zedekiah, and Shalom. And we know from what is revealed in these scriptures that we're now really digging into that three of those sons of Josiah ruled as kings of Judah after him. So that's going to be, in fact, Zedekiah is the last king, the 19th and final king of Judah. Josiah's son, Johanan, who was known as Jehoahaz, became king after Josiah when he died. His reign was very brief, only 3 months. He was removed from the throne by Necho, the Pharaoh of Egypt, the one who had slain Josiah when he went out to meet him when the Egyptians came led by Necho, their Pharaoh, to go meet the Assyrians. And so Josiah went and met him, and he was smitten there at that time and then died from those wounds. And so then Jehoahaz, or Johanan as he's referred to in 1 Chronicles 3:15, that firstborn son of Josiah was made king after him by the people, but then Necho rapidly removed him and then put his brother Jehoiakim on the throne. And Necho carried Jehoahaz down to Egypt, where he remained for the rest of his days. So he had a very brief reign and then was carried to Egypt, then Jehoiakim reigned. We're just giving really an overview of what we're going to look at in detail here over the next few times of study, Lord willing. But then Jehoiakim reigned 11 years, and then his son, which would be a grandson of Josiah, Jehoiachin, who's also referred to as Jeconiah or Coniah, known by three names in the scriptures. He became king after Jehoiakim, but he was another one that had a very brief reign on the throne of Judah, as he had also a 3 month reign and was then removed from the throne by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and he was carried away to Babylon and remained there the rest of his days. So that very closely followed that pattern of his uncle, Jehoahaz, but it was Babylon instead of Egypt. But anyway, then after his removal, Nebuchadnezzar had Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, placed on the throne of Judah, and that proved to be the final king that ever reigned in Jerusalem on David's throne over that earthly kingdom. Of course, Jesus later came from that same line and inherited that throne, which he is sitting upon now, reigning over his spiritual kingdom, which we're a part of when we are in him and in his church. So all of that has relevance, all these things that we're reading and the genealogies and all of this as it pertains to that also. So that's very important for us always to keep in mind as we're studying these kings, especially the ones of Judah, as it later leads to the King of Kings. So that's just an overview of what's coming with these final four kings of Judah. It'll be a son of Josiah, and then another son of Josiah, then a grandson of Josiah, and then another son of Josiah. So it's going to end with the very next generation following that righteous king of Judah that we studied about, Josiah. But sadly, all of these descendants of his, those sons of his, and the grandson that we read about, they're all going to be described by the Lord as doing evil in his sight. This is something that is, unfortunately, right along the lines of what everybody else was doing in Judah at that time, with the exception, of course, of Josiah himself. Jeremiah the prophet, who was a contemporary of Josiah's for a time. But let's turn to Zephaniah chapter 1, and I think we briefly looked at the statement of verse 8, but we want to read verses 1 through 8 here in the book of the prophet Zephaniah. This is one of these books that's referred to as the Minor Prophets, not a lengthy book, but here in these first eight verses, we're going to see the time in which the word of the Lord came to Zephaniah, and then what the Lord had to say about Josiah's children. So Zephaniah was one of these prophets that prophesied in the time of Josiah, king of Judah. There were a lot of prophets that were around after Isaiah. There were Isaiah and some that were prophesying in during the time of Hezekiah. We saw we saw some of the ones that were also along with that when we were studying about Hosea being one of them that was around during Isaiah's time that we studied when we were looking at the time of Hezekiah. But from then up until this time to the end of Judah being in existence as a kingdom, as only a remnant ended up surviving and got carried away to Babylon for 70 years before returning. And we could expect, with all those events going on, that that would have been a time when there would have been a lot of activity of the Lord's prophets. The Lord did send many prophets during those days. There was a lot of wickedness going on. Hezekiah had brought the people back to the Lord during his time. But there were prophets that were very much around, not just in Israel, but also in Judah, during that time when Judah was doing so much evil through the reign of Ahaz, Hezekiah's father. And then Isaiah started, he was prophesying during that time, and then through the reign of Hezekiah. And as we mentioned, Hosea was around at that time also, and some others. But then after Hezekiah, Manasseh came along and did all of that evil. And so there were many prophets sent then. Did Manasseh listen to any of them or the people? No. How did the Lord finally reach Manasseh? When he had him carried away by the Assyrians in fetters to Babylon. And then he finally repented. But the people didn't. And his own son Amon, the father of Josiah, didn't. So there were a lot of prophets around then. And as we also will see, the Lord sends many prophets during Josiah's time. Now, Josiah, during his reign, of course, is following the Lord and has all the people of Judah swear to a covenant to serve the Lord and keep all of his commandments with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. They swear to that covenant. But were they sincerely following those words? They were not. So did the Lord have use then to continue to send prophets when the hearts of the people hadn't turned to him? Yes, and as we know, the Lord was going to pour out his wrath upon them for all of this evil. He deferred the bringing of that judgment that he had promised during Josiah's days because of Josiah's humility and righteousness. But now he's going to bring it to pass in the time of Josiah's children. And so we see the words of many prophets during these days. Zephaniah is another one. And so in chapter 1 of Zephaniah, verse 1, it says, "The word of the Lord which came unto Zephaniah, the son of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hizkiah, in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah." So that tells us when Zephaniah was sent by the Lord to speak these words. It's during Josiah's time. He says, starting in verse 2, "I will utterly consume all things from off the land, saith the Lord." Does this sound consistent with what he said to Josiah when Josiah heard the words of the book of the law of the Lord after it was discovered in the 18th year of his reign? And then he spoke through hold of the prophetess to answer Josiah at that time. But the Lord said these very same things to Josiah when he said, "I'm not going to do it in your days," but he was going to do it and was not going to pardon that innocent blood that was shed, that Jerusalem was filled with, going back to the days of Manasseh. So here in Zephaniah, chapter 1, verse 2, "I will utterly consume all things from off the land, saith the Lord." Does that sound like a severe judgment that's coming? That's a very severe judgment. Verse 3 says, "I will consume man and beast. I will consume the fowls of the heaven and the fishes of the sea and the stumbling blocks with the wicked. And I will cut off man from off the land, saith the Lord." It's interesting in verse 3 there. He categorizes the wicked there. And what are the two categories? Well, the ones who are doing wickedly, which, who is that at this time? Everybody. With the pretty much the exception of just Josiah and these prophets. But everybody else has been following evil, and they don't return to the Lord except faintedly. So he's describing what's going on with all the people, yet he still distinguishes between the wicked and who else? The stumbling blocks. Does the Lord identify which ones are being used by the devil in his work to cause others to stumble? I mean, all the evil that's going on that takes place at any time, for evil to go on, I mean, they're leaders of it, aren't there? I mean, it doesn't just happen. And is the devil disorganized? Yeah, that would be. We do wish he were disorganized. That would make things a lot easier for us, but he's not disorganized. That means, and when we read the scriptures, does the devil have plans? He very much has plans. He has plans for individuals. He has plans for nations and kingdoms. He's got lots of plans. Now, he's not able to carry out any of those plans except what the Lord will permit him to do. That will be in keeping with whatever the Lord's will is. For any individuals, nations, kingdoms, the world as a whole. So anything that the devil ends up doing is all going to fit into God's own plans and according to his will. But the devil has lots of plans, and he's very organized. Now, as soon as we recognize that and we give, we do in that sense give the devil his due, that he is credited with all of this evil that he's doing. He's going to be judged for that. I mean, he's the ultimate stumbling block, isn't he? I mean, he's the father of lies, that one who was a murderer from the beginning. I mean, he's the organizer of all of it. But as soon as we recognize that and then see how he uses, well, he's got all the, I mean, who is in his employ, so to speak? Who are his servants? Well, I mean, he's got spiritual beings that are in his service, doesn't he? There are lots of evil spirits. We don't know the number, but all those ones that are identified as evil spirits, devils, his angels, his messengers. So he has some host of devils that he is using in his service. So he's got a lot of evil spirits that he's using in his work. But then he's got all these, in this world, all kinds of men that are being used. I mean, he's got these devils under him that he's got organized, and then all these different evil people that he's using in his service, all according to his plans and whatever the Lord will permit him to do. Now, when we recognize that, if we start talking about that, the eye rolls start coming from, and the scorning will come and scoffing from some people because, that sounds like a big conspiracy. Well, is there a conspiracy? Is there an evil conspiracy? Is the devil conspiring? That's another way to ask it. So, yeah, there's a big conspiracy from the devil to make evil happen in this world. And when is he not conspiring? Yeah, when is he not lying? I mean, this is going on all the time. So does it suit our purposes? Is it good for us to think, well, things just happen, pop up here and there randomly with some kind of evil, but there's no organization to all of this? That's naive and very foolish for us to look at things that way. We need to recognize who our adversary is and how he works. We're seeing it on display here. So he uses different ones, these devils and men, and they're ones that he uses in his service to lead evil to happen, and among God's people particularly. And they're false teachers, many will follow their pernicious ways, as the Lord warns us about in 2 Peter 1, chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Does that sound like there's a conspiracy? There is. Now, does that mean everybody that's involved in the devil's conspiracies recognize their role in it? Not necessarily. But even the ones who do, that are willfully planning different things, do they really know what they're doing, or are they blind too? I mean, they've got strong delusions, and so the devil's able to deceive different ones. So how many people that are doing evil think they're really doing some kind of good in some way? I mean, they all do. But they're doing their evil. They can rationalize it because of the strong delusion that's there. But these ones are stumbling blocks. So we see there the Lord makes that distinction. And who's going to get the worst judgment? I mean, what does he say about someone who offends one of his little ones, causes them to become ensnared in sin? What did Jesus say about that, Matthew 18? It'd be better for, have a millstone tied around his neck and cast into the sea. There's going to be a very harsh judgment for anyone that is used by the devil as a stumbling block for God's children. So that's in there in verse 3 as well. So verse 4 here in Zephaniah 1, he says, I will also stretch out mine hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place, and the name of the Chimerims with the priests, and them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops, and them that worship and that swear by the Lord and that swear by Malcolm. Were there any that were worshiping and serving falsehood alongside of Jehovah here? Yeah. And he points out these ones that were doing both. So many of them still added Jehovah's name onto whatever they were doing, along with all of these others, this wicked that they're doing. And Just like a lot of people will use the name of Jesus and attach that and profess some belief in or allegiance to him while they're doing all of their evil as well. So that was being done in Jude at this time. But I mean, what weren't they doing? When you really look at verses 4 and 5, as far as false religion was concerned, what line did they have? Had they drawn to say, okay, that's going too far? We already know they were killing their children in sacrifice to these idols. I mean, if you don't have a line drawn there, where are you going to draw one? What are you not willing to do then? And so he's describing all. They were worshiping everything. So in verse 6, he says, "And them that are turned back from the Lord, and those that have not sought the Lord nor inquired for him." So there's a further categorization. That wasn't coming out right. He's making more categories of the wicked there. But some have never served, never turned to the Lord at all. Some served him and then turned away from him. Is that true today also? I mean, they're people that are wicked in this world. There's the stumbling blocks over them, in particular the ones that the stumbling blocks are going to affect mostly are ones who were following the Lord that they're going to cause to stumble and fall away from him. Now, there are plenty that never do turn to the Lord. So he's covering all of that. All of that existed here among God's people, just like we have all of that around today too. Verse 7, he says, "Hold thy peace at the presence of the Lord God, for the day of the Lord is at hand. For the Lord hath prepared a sacrifice, and he hath bid his guests." Now, this is not something that he's describing here that anybody would want to have an invitation to or be a party to. This sacrifice that the Lord was going to, that he was preparing. So he's preparing it, and he's bid his guests. And so in verse 8 he says, "And it shall come to pass in the day of the Lord's sacrifice." Who was going to be among the guests here? He says, "That I will punish the princes and the king's children and all such as are clothed with strange apparel." Now, when he's singling out the ones that he's particularly going to go after here, he really is honing in on these stumbling blocks, these leaders, the princes, he says, and the king's children. Now, in whose days is Zephaniah uttering these words? In the days of Josiah. So who's the king and who are his children? These ones that we're looking at, these ones that are going to be kings after him. But even in his days, what is the Lord seeing in the heart of Josiah's children at this time? Now, here's a question. Were they openly defying Josiah during that time? I mean, we don't read the details of what they did until they became kings. But we do have the Lord pointing out who they were and what kind of hearts they had here before they ever became kings. And he was going to punish them. So God is testifying to the evil of Josiah's children right here. Sad as that is, in his days, in his own time, did Josiah know it? What are the chances are that those sons of his were openly defying him, that they were doing all of these evil things right in the presence of their father? Well, what do we know about Josiah? If they had tried to build a high place or do something like that in his time, what would he have done? I mean, he would have done something about that immediately. He was tolerating no deviation from following God's commandments. After the law of the Lord was found, that's when he made all the people swear to that covenant. Were his sons there on that day when Josiah was reading all the words of that book before the people in their ears? And then making him swear to that covenant, did he exempt his own sons from that? There's no way he did. So did Josiah put forth the effort to teach his children to follow the Lord? There's no question about that. With all that the Lord says about Josiah and his zeal for the Lord and for righteousness that we read, there's no question that he would have been making that a great priority of his, to have his own children to know the Lord and to follow him. Which means, as the Lord is seeing their hearts and seeing them as evil, there's no way they would have been standing up and openly doing evil like that. So in Josiah's time, they would have been what? What do we call them? They were faking it, like all the people. Were they hypocrites? They were being hypocrites. As long as the old man was around, they were going to do what they had to do, what he told them to do, but they were being hypocrites. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we have what the Lord said. Let's go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 34. I know we read this when we were studying about Josiah, but just to revisit this to see how it applies to the people at this time, now that Josiah has passed on, he's gone. Nobody's going to have to do anything because Josiah is making them do it anymore. He's out of the way. And now his first son, Jehoahaz, becomes king after him, who is evil. Well, who does he have to fake it for now? Who does Jehoahaz have to pretend to be righteous for anymore? Nobody. He's the king now. And that same is going to be true of his brethren. They're not going to be pretending anymore. So they can throw off the hypocrisy. Now they can do what they really want to do anyway. The old man is gone. The king is dead. And so they're going to do as they desire. And they're going to do evil. But they weren't alone. I mean, this is what all the people were like. And that's what we were seeing that there in Zephaniah chapter 1. And this is what the Lord told us about this in 2 Chronicles 34. This is after Josiah, after the law of the Lord was discovered and he heard it. And then it tells us in verses 29 through 33 what he did with the people. It says, "And the king sent and gathered together all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem." This is 2 Chronicles 34, 29 to 33. "Then the king sent and gathered together all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem. And the king went up into the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the priests and the Levites and all the people, great and small." Does it say except for his own children? No, it doesn't. They were there. No doubt about it. He says, he read in their ears all the words of the book and the covenant that was found in the house of the Lord. And the king stood in his place and made a covenant before the Lord to walk after the Lord and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and with all his soul, to perform the words of the covenant which are written in this book." All right, so who made the covenant to do that? Who swore first to do it? Josiah. And verse 32 says, "And he caused all that were present in Jerusalem and Benjamin to stand to it." So he swore to this covenant. Now, did he follow it? Yes, he did. And we're told that he did so. There was no king before him or after him like that in doing this. And then he caused all that were present in Jerusalem and Benjamin to stand to it. Does it say except for his own children? No, it doesn't say that, for a reason. "And the inhabitants of Jerusalem did according to the covenant of God, the God of their fathers, and Josiah took away all the abominations out of the countries that pertained to the children of Israel, and made all that were present in Israel to serve, even to serve the Lord their God. And all his days they departed not from following the Lord, the God of their fathers." So they swore to this covenant. Why? What does it say in verse 32? He caused all that were present to stand to it. Who made him do it? And then verse 33, it says, "And Josiah made all that were present in Israel to serve the Lord their God." So why did they serve the Lord their God? Because Josiah made him do it. And they did it how long? All his days, Josiah's days, they departed not from following the Lord, the God of their fathers. So what did they do as soon as he was gone? The restraint was out of the way, and they were free to do what they desired to do. It's so sad to read that. Of course, we have the testimony that we've looked at before, but Won't hurt just to see it one more time here from Jeremiah chapter 3. In fact, we're going to actually go to chapter 1 and look at verses 1 through 3 that tells us when Jeremiah served as God's prophet. It says, "The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests that were in Anathoth in the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of the Lord came in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign." It's interesting, it even tells specifically the year that in Josiah's reign that this happened. So it was in the 13th year of Josiah's reign. Now, how old was Josiah when he became king? We remember he was 8 years old. And it was in what year of his reign, and how old was he when it says that he turned to seek the God of his fathers? That was in the 8th year of his reign, when he was 16 years old. That was what he said, told us in the book of 2 Chronicles in chapter 34. So he sought the Lord, Josiah did. He turned to seek him and started doing that when he was 16 years old in the 8th year of his reign. So it's only 5 years after that. So he was 21 years old when Jeremiah begins to prophesy. Now, what year did the word, did the law of the Lord, was it discovered in the temple? That was in his 18th year. So 5 years after Jeremiah started to prophesy. And it's interesting to look at the timing of that. So did Josiah start to seek the law of the Lord because Jeremiah came along and said, "You need to do that"? No, that was 5 years later. Yet it's also interesting that it's 5 years before the discovery of the law there. So could the Lord have brought about that discovery before Jeremiah came along, or even immediately after? It's interesting to see the timing of that the Lord had Jeremiah get started for 5 years before he revealed his law again to the people. I mean, was that happenstance in the timing of it, the discovery of the law? Was the Lord in control of all that? I mean, the Lord was in control of all that, the timing of it and everything. I mean, Josiah had already turned to the Lord, but the Lord worked that, so that law was found at that time, but it was 5 years after Jeremiah started prophesying. So Josiah was already hearing those warnings from Jeremiah. So, I mean, and he had already gotten well started in trying to clean up the idolatry of the land. He knew that was wrong. And, of course, there was Jeremiah's testimony going on. It had gotten started before them. But then when he found the law of the Lord in his 18th year, that's when we know what happened after that, when he fully made all the people do all of those things that God had said. But it is interesting to see the exact timing of when Jeremiah got started during Josiah's reign in his 13th year. And verse 3 says, it came also in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. Why doesn't it include Jehoahaz here? Well, how long was he king? 3 months. There wasn't much time for a lot of Jeremiah's work to be done in that 3 months. So it's really just skipping over that to the 11 years of Jehoiakim's reign. So he's the first king after Josiah to reign. I mean, it's only 3 months after Josiah's death that Jehoiakim is on the throne. So we see him mentioned there in verse 3. "Came also in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, unto the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, unto the carrying away of Jerusalem captive in the 5th month." So Jeremiah's career as a prophet started in Josiah's 13th year, and it carried all the way, well, as far as the period of the kings, to the end. Now, Jeremiah's career as the Lord's prophet, the Lord was still using him after that, even after the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. But anyway, that's mentioned very specifically there in the beginning of the book of Jeremiah. So it's in chapter 3 that it's in Josiah's days, he tells us in verse 6, Jeremiah 3, verse 6, "The Lord said also unto me in the days of Josiah the king." Well, since Jeremiah prophesied, I mean, we have a long book, what, 52 chapters. How do we know at any particular chapter, or if we start looking at a passage in the book of Jeremiah? I mean, that's a long period of time that he served as the Lord's prophet. I mean, it covered many of the years of Josiah's reign, and then all that happened after Josiah to the end of the kingdom of Judah, the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the temple, and then after that even. How do we know when we're looking at a particular passage in Jeremiah when in all of that, those years, that any particular statement is made? Well, we have to look at the context when the Lord tells us and identifies the timing, which he does very frequently throughout the book of Jeremiah. So we have to keep that in mind, and that's not just for the book of Jeremiah, with the other prophets also, especially those ones where we have the major ones where we have so much information in them that covers a long period of time. But this is an example of that. So in chapter 3, we might be wondering if he just spoke about the hypocrisy of the people, we might be wondering, well, exactly when was that? Well, we don't have to wonder that because the Lord tells us here in verse 6, "The Lord said also unto me, in the days of Josiah the king, hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel hath done? She has gone up upon every high mountain and under every green tree, and there hath played the harlot. And I said, after she had done all these things, turn thou unto me, but she returned not. And her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce." Now, in whose reign did that happen? That divorce came in the time of Hezekiah when he was king. That's when the northern kingdom of Israel fell. And they their remnant was scattered among the territories of the Assyrians. "Yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also." And it came to, and especially after Hezekiah's time, that was that's exactly what they did. Verse 9 says, "And it came to pass through the lightness of her whoredom that she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and with stocks. And yet for all this, her treacherous sister Judah hath not turned unto me with her whole heart, but feignedly, saith the Lord. And the Lord said unto me, the backsliding Israel had justified herself more than treacherous Judah." So what does he say about, what did the Lord see with this covenant that they all swore to follow him with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength? I mean, he saw all the hypocrisy, he saw what was in their hearts. They didn't mean it. They were faking it. They were hypocrites. Now, what do we know about Josiah's own children? Were they part of that hypocrisy or were they not? They were. So with all Josiah, now, where in here is Josiah faulted for his efforts? What more could he have done? Another thing to consider, with all the evil that was going on there, and Josiah turned to the Lord with all of his heart, where was he going to find a wife that had a heart the same? I mean, he had God's people to choose among. It's just a consideration. We're told about the mothers of his children, but we're not told about them. Is it possible that he got some hypocrites for wives too? It's very possible. So his children may have learned hypocrisy. They didn't learn hypocrisy from Josiah, the father, but maybe they learned it from the mother. But even if their mothers were righteous, I mean, how much hypocrisy was around to learn from in Judah at that time? I mean, there was no shortage of it, however it came. But they were part of it, and that was widespread in Judah throughout Josiah's days. But now once he's gone, they don't have to be hypocrites anymore, his children or anybody else. And they're not. The hypocrisy of Judah is no longer present after Josiah. We're going to see very open wickedness practiced by the people. So in 2 Kings chapter 23 with Jehoahaz, just to revisit this briefly, this is the setting that we see that we can now identify Jehoahaz and see what kind of person he was and understand the background there. And the evil that he chose to do in spite of who his father was. So 2 Kings 23, we want to look at verses 30 to 34. Now keep in mind, this is right after Pharaoh Necho, because it says in verse 29, in his, Josiah's days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up against the king of Assyria to the river Euphrates, and King Josiah went against him, and he slew him at Megiddo when he had seen him. So that's how Josiah died. So Pharaoh Necho was up there in that area. Josiah dies. Verse 30, and his servants carried him in a chariot dead from Megiddo and brought him to Jerusalem and buried him in his own sepulcher. And the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and anointed him and made him king in his father's stead. So whose choice was it for Jehoahaz to be the next king of Judah to succeed Josiah on the throne? It was the people. Of course, it was God. But this was the will of the people of Judah, and wasn't that the custom? I mean, he's the firstborn son. I mean, that's naturally who they would anoint to be the successor of Josiah as king of Judah. Verse 31 says, Jehoahaz, this is going to be significant because of what we're going to read after this and why his reign was only 3 months long. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. This is not Jeremiah the prophet. Jeremiah the prophet, we just read that a moment ago. I don't know if you cataloged the town that he was from, but where was Jeremiah from? Anathoth. That was one of the priestly cities of Benjamin, and that's where Jeremiah was from. So this Jeremiah of Libna is not Jeremiah the prophet. In fact, Jeremiah the prophet was too young to have been this one anyway at the time. So, but what more do we know about Hamutal, the mother of Jehoahaz? That's it. That's all we know. So did she make a covenant, swear to that covenant to follow the Lord along with Josiah? If she were still around, then without question she would have. Was she sincere in that? Well, we're not told, so we just need to keep in mind the possibility that's there. We don't know what his mother was like, so Jehoahaz may have had a hypocrite for a mother. Perhaps not. But verse 32 says, gives us the bottom line. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done, except for his actual father, Josiah. But all those other ones that we've read about, I mean, he followed in the footsteps of all those wicked ones before him. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. How sad to see that, though, when we read all about Josiah, that and all the efforts that he made with all the people, himself, I mean, with utter sincerity, he gave himself to serve the Lord with all of his heart and tried to get everybody else to do the same. And his family too, without question, but no one listened. No one would do it, and to see that failure is sad for Josiah, with that all that work that he tried to do was unsuccessful, with the ultimate aim of converting these people. But that's not going to be a condemnation of Josiah. It's going to be a condemnation and. There's that much more that his the judgment of his children, is that going to be a light one with the upbringing that they had, with what they knew? Was much given to them through Josiah their father? And will the Lord require that of them in the judgment? And he will. But it's sad to see that with a righteous man like that, that all these children of his are evil. So in verse 33, it says, and Pharaoh Necho put him in bands at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that he might not reign in Jerusalem. And he put the land to a tribute of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. And Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the room of Josiah his father, and turned his name to Jehoiakim, and took Jehoahaz away, and he came to Egypt and died there. That's what happened to Jehoahaz. 3 months that he reigned. Now, had Pharaoh Necho returned and gone back to Egypt? It certainly does not appear that that's the case. He made the journey up there to meet the king of Assyria. That's when Josiah came out and met him and was slain. And so this is in a 3 month period of time. The people then anoint his son as a successor. And it certainly appears that before Necho and all of his army has returned down to Egypt again, the new king is on the throne there. Well, Necho's there with all of his army. The Pharaoh agree with this choice of Jehoahaz to be the king of Judah? He did not. We don't have all the details, but Jehoahaz, what does he do at this time when he removes, what does Necho do when he removes Jehoahaz and puts Jehoiakim on the throne? He then carries the deposed king back to Egypt with him, and he stays there the rest of his days and dies in Egypt. And all this is within this 3 month period of time. We don't know how long he lived in Egypt. Removal of Jehoahaz from the throne, putting Jehoiakim on the throne, and what else was going on at this time? What did he do with the land? Put them to tribute. When he places Jehoiakim on the throne, would that be with an agreement to pay tribute to Pharaoh? There's no doubt. That's what you call a puppet. He installed a puppet king on the throne that would have been in agreement, in submission to him. Well, Jehoahaz wasn't. Jehoahaz got placed on the throne not at the behest of Pharaoh with some agreement to pay tribute. Necho was not satisfied with having someone. Did he feel like he had the same control over Jehoahaz that he was going to have over Jehoiakim? Obviously not. So he felt like he was going to have full control over this king. So he's making Judah into a vassal state of Egypt in control of their king. Judah now is under the thumb of Egypt. Well, is that a position that God's going to put his people under when they're doing right? Certainly not. And again, this we're looking at, when we're considering why did God have Josiah's end come the way that he did, we can see the Lord is doing a lot of things here. And much of it has to do with his punishment of the evil of his people. And so putting them under tribute and under the control of Egypt and of all the enemies. What is Egypt to Israel? This is the nation that they were led out of bondage from, and the Lord had forbidden them to ever go back there. Egypt remained. This is a symbol of Israel's bondage that they had broken free from, and the Lord did not want them to have any association with Egypt. He forbade them from going there. He forbade them from seeking their assistance. So now to put them under Egypt's control, this is a very big situation in a bad way for Judah. Now, this is not something that God is going to let be permanent. But this is something he was doing, and this is part of this punishment. God is now bringing his judgment on them. He deferred it until after Josiah. This is part of it. So Jehoahaz is put on the throne and taken off. Well, we're going to very quickly read 2 Chronicles 36, 4 to 8, that is the parallel of 2 Chronicles 36, 1 to 4, that is the parallel to 2 Kings 23, 30 to 34 that we just read, and we'll call it, bring it to a close there, and then start to look at Jehoiakim next week, Lord willing. But 2 Chronicles 36, 1 to 4, and by the way, we're now starting the final chapter of 2 Chronicles. It says, then the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and made him king in his father's stead in Jerusalem. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. And the king of Egypt put him down at Jerusalem and condemned the land in 100 talents of silver and 1 talent of gold. And the king of Egypt made Eliakim, his brother, king over Judah and Jerusalem, and turned his name to Jehoiakim. And Necho took Jehoahaz, his brother, and carried him to Egypt. So it says the same thing there. Well, how much control do you have over somebody when you are the one to, here you are deciding who, which one is king and what his name is going to be, what name he's going to be called by? I mean, that's full control right there. You're now king, and your name is now this, and you owe me this much money a year. I mean, that's dictating the terms, isn't it? That's how under the thumb of Egypt they now are, very suddenly. That's the background then when Jehoiakim becomes king, really at the pleasure of Pharaoh. But then God's going to do something about Egypt here. And preparation for looking at that, I'm requesting that you read Jeremiah chapter 46. This is the Lord's condemnation of Egypt and his prophecy of Egypt's destruction, which is fulfilled by Nebuchadnezzar in Jehoiakim's 4th year. So this is going to be a very brief 3 to 4 year subjugation of Judah by Egypt, and then God's going to judge Egypt and Necho, which he needs to be with all this going on, doesn't he? And so the Lord's going to abase him pretty soon. You can read Jeremiah chapter 46 where the Lord gives details of that, because it's not in 2 Kings or 2 Chronicles. We'll close now. Let's go to our Heavenly Father again in prayer.